Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 28th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon is Dale Jampgard with session number 2009 titled Far More Is Possible Than You Can Imagine. Go Heal the Sick. Let's listen in.
I'm Dale Jampgard and welcome. Had a wonderful 2 weeks here at Holden. And how many of you have been in one of my sessions before? How many have not been in one before? Okay. I ask that because a lot of what I do each session is somewhat based on what we've done previously. And so I'll take just a minute to catch you up. For those of you who haven't been in other sessions, I'm retired, but I have worked both as a parish pastor and as a psychotherapist in private practice. And I was director of life education for Lutheran Family Service in Portland, Oregon. I now live in Portland. I've been doing sessions here since 1972, about every 3 or 4 years, so this place feels like home. The theme that I've been working with this week has been the theme, Far More Is Possible Than You Can Imagine. And certainly as we hear what Jesus talks about and offers, he seems to be urging us to open up our vision and our span of expectation, possibility. And in many ways, we have shut that down because of scientific developments, I think. But it started happening even before that. St. Augustine started out by saying, you know, the healings and miracles that Jesus did were mainly related to his showing his divinity and to the New Testament times, but we can't expect anything like that to happen. And then he began to notice that a lot of healings seemed to be happening. So in his later years in his diocese, why, he had people recording all those events that seemed to be miraculous, unexplainable, so forth. And he said in 2 years they had 71 events. It's interesting because that's kind of what's been happening recently. The Institute for Noetic Science has instituted a recording of a lot of the, quotes, paranormal, miraculous, all kinds of incidents, and they're beginning just to compile a whole wealth of stories. And of course, we've distrusted those based on our scientific understanding, saying, well, something must have happened. And so we have not tended to trust that anything really miraculous happens, but if it does, then we make it a real super miracle of God, that it's totally outside of nature. Luther went along with that in some ways. What he said is, let's not be focused on the miraculous healings and so forth, but rather, he said, the miracle of the gospel, people hearing the gospel message and finding freedom in the gospel is the real miracle. So let's focus on the preaching and the sacraments, and let's not focus on healing, was the implication. And I think our Lutheran church really bought that and has moved away from, for many years, much corporate approach to healing. Certainly pastors would go pray, and yet there was a sense, I grew up in the Lutheran church, and there was a sense in which we prayed, but I didn't really expect something to happen. I thought, well, you know, you pray and you hope maybe for a miracle, but it's rather unlikely. When I was a kid, I had broken my arm and broke the ball off playing Tarzan in the garage. I jumped and grabbed a hold of a 2x4, not figuring out that you can't hang on to it if you're swinging. My hands fell off and I fell and broke my elbow. And but I was rushed to the clinic and they put my arm in a cast. And after 6 weeks, I took my arm out of a cast and it was weak from not having used it. And took another 2, 3, 4 weeks. Anyway, after 2.5 months or so, I began to really use my arm. Well, a little boy across the street playing on our swing took a swing and flew out of the swing and got up holding his arm, and his arm was bent like this. And there was no doubt about the break. And he went home, and I kept waiting for them to rush off to the clinic. But they didn't. Instead, cars began to arrive. And what they did was they straightened the arm as best they could. And they people began to come and they prayed. And for a couple of days, they prayed and they'd sing some nice songs, nice relaxing, and very prayerful, very expectant, not frenetic, but just, God is at work here. And I think it was on the fourth day, he comes outside with his arm in a sling. And the next week, while he was beginning to use his arm, and I went, wow, that's a different approach. Man, they really expected that to happen. Now, certainly I was glad that the medical service was there. But that wasn't the total answer, nor was their way the total answer. And I think we're beginning to open up now that faith and prayer have a real place in the healing process. And what I've talked about in many of my sessions is that part of what's opening that up for us is quantum physics, which is calling into question some of the presumptions of Newtonian physics. Newtonian physics that said essentially that if we can figure out the smallest part, we'll understand the whole, has certainly made major contributions to our well-being, but it also made some assumptions that limited the possibility of our understanding of life. Quantum physics is, in a very cursory way, saying things are really happenings and that there's a dynamic happening and we don't really know how it all happens because there's a lot of mysteries. Electrons appear here and then over here and we don't know how they get there. And if you observe any action, you change the action, so you can't really know what's happening because your observation changes what you look at, or the instrument you're using to measure it changes whatever's happening. So that quantum physics is changing a lot of our assumptions for the better, I think, because when we thought of ourselves as a mechanical it, then it was difficult to think that faith, I'm here, God is there, what difference could faith make in this it, I think has been the struggle we've had. I think with a dynamic happening, that we're dynamic happening, and that that this whole happening, trying to figure out how much I can explain briefly. One idea is that a boson, which is a particle, lasts a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a second, and that things are made up of bosons. That's one of the particles. Well, the mystical kinds of physicists are saying, well, what exists between each happening of the boson? Is what exists purpose? And if purpose exists between the happenings, maybe what we're really made up of is purpose. Maybe what we're really made up of is word. And then we remember Jesus saying, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. So possibly God is saying the word that becomes you, is manifested as you every moment of our existence and every moment. That creation is ongoing. Well, and what is Jesus doing? He says the word, you shall be healed, this shall happen. And it happens. And then what does he do? He says, hey, you guys, You can say the word. Pray. Say what it is. Ask. Knock. Seek. But ask for what you want. Ask for what you see needed. And it will happen. So we're beginning to understand the power of word. Power of understanding. And maybe the word becomes flesh. Maybe that's how creation always happens. And so what things are really made of is word. That's a condensation. Maybe that's also why, investment-wise, computers and knowledge, we're in the age where the tremendous investment of our funds and our interest is in how to manage knowledge. That knowledge is now the product, not the it. So, a lot of changes taking place. Often in our orientation to prayer, we thought of the process is that I pray to God. I pray to God, and God does something to you. Well, as we begin to understand communication and the ability to be in touch with people in ways that telepathy, healing, prayers, intentions, sensing what's going to happen with other people, person in one part of the country knows what has happened to their loved one 3,000 miles away. A lot of stories like this. So I'm wondering if in prayer there is not also another, what I just cited you were instances of connections between people. I and you may communicate, be in touch on this kind of a level. Well, I'm wondering if prayer isn't a combination. That prayer is praying to God and entering into a presence with the person for whom we're praying on a direct level. I do. That if we really tune into someone and sense their need, that in prayer we can be with them and share our concern for them, our compassion for them, our love for them, and lift up the hopes for healing. So what's happening now, I think, is this is showing up more and more in scientific research and raising the question of whether it's not a combination. Any comments on that? Think that's a possibility?
Totally. Mm-hmm. No question.
Okay. Well, I like experience. And so what I'd like to do is give you an opportunity at least to experience how this might happen for you. Because the whole idea that we can be in touch or communicate with another person for us is for the most part, we have programmed ourselves out of that, to not expect it, to not do it, to not really, really believe that it's something we can do. And yet I believe that everyone has the capacity to tune into another person and to know them at a distance. So what I'd like to do is an exercise with you that I've done a number of times with people, and they've had some interesting results. It's an exercise called remote viewing. And what that means is tuning in to another person and letting yourself see what they see. The process will be that I'm going to have you get a partner before long here and tune into each other, and I'll guide you just in a way of kind of experiencing the connection between the two of you. And then I will ask one of you to go outside and look at a scene. And then I will invite your partner to draw what the other person is looking at. And now you might say, "Oh boy." Recently I did this exercise with a group of people, and one lady, when her partner came back, says, "I can't do this kind of stuff. And all I see is just a bunch of parallel lines." And the person said, "Oh, I was standing looking at grass, tall grass. Looks just like that." And another person, my wife, some of you may have heard this story, but anyway, she was standing looking at where the roof meets the side of a house. And the person drew that kind of an angle, that kind of connection. And another person said, "Gee, I saw this rectangle here, and a rectangle here, and a circle." You know, didn't know what it was. The person said, "I was standing looking at a fireplace pit. There was a circle of rocks, and there's a bench here, and a bench here." So I know that those kinds of things can happen. They may or may not happen with you, but if you're game, well, I'd like to guide you through that and see what happens. Open to doing that? Okay. I will invite you then to pair off with someone you don't know. Just some stranger, get together with someone you don't know, and sit facing each other. Move around, set up a couple chairs. With name and where you're from and all that stuff, okay, but now I'd like to have you close your eyes for a moment. Move into yourself. Bring your awareness to your breathing. Just kind of let go. Now, my sense is that God has given us a connection to every person, and that we can know one another with our hearts. Knowing with the heart warmth is that kind of affirming, accepting openness to really know a person, not figure them out, but to just know them. So begin to experience the knowing from your heart center. And then open up your hands towards them and sense their presence. You may even sense the energy, some warmth, some sensations that you may not even know what it is. But I believe you can sense the presence of another person. It's like letting yourself truly be with this other person. Now let your eyes slowly open and stay soft and unfocused. And notice that you can see the whole person in the background. You can receive the person. And now between you decide who is going to be A and who is going to be B. What I'd like you to do is to go outside and find some view, look at something specific, and it can be big or small, but something specific, and just stand there for a minute and look at it, and then come back. And A's, what I want you to do is just close your eyes and be with your partner. And after they've had a chance to get located, let you draw whatever they're looking at on your piece of paper. Just let your hands draw whatever comes to you. So get your pencils and papers. Okay, now begin to receive whatever images come to you. And let your hands just begin to draw whatever seems to come down on the paper. Okay, now just share whatever you noticed, whatever came to you. Okay, may I have your attention, please? What are some of the things you noticed? What was it like?
The way it's supposed to be.
What happened?
Connected.
You connected.
Because we're all one.
Okay. Okay.
Partial connection.
Partial connection.
Yeah. I chose not to look. I looked at a person who was walking around. He was, and part of what she saw was that person, and I could identify on a picture what that was.
Okay.
And we had about, I'd say, 85% type agreement as to what he was looking at, and the lines and kids on the wall and whatnot.
Okay.
And it was more not so much seeing the kids, it was hearing them, being aware that they were there.
Ah.
It's not a small call.
I was looking at this menorah through the window, and what was fun, it doesn't have any candles on it right now, but when I came back, she had seven straight things with lines with yellow on top. So she said she thought maybe I was looking at flowers. But those, so it was, although the candles weren't in the menorah, it was very much a part of what I was picturing. I was filling in the candles in the menorah in my own head.
Ah, okay.
You know?
You were imagining the candles.
Yeah.
Ah, interesting, okay.
I looked at this proposed out here.
Yeah.
Just got kind of some funny angles to it, and she drew the angles.
Okay.
And what did you see as you walked in through the door?
Pardon?
What did you say when we walked in?
Oh, I said, I'll be surprised if this works.
And I kept getting, even almost as soon as they had gotten out the door, I kept getting the angle kind of image, and I thought roof line maybe or something. And then when he went out and showed me the post, I'm like, oh. That's weird.
I denied my first impulse.
Mm-hmm, me too.
And I guess I denied it because I felt that I had the preconceived that that's what she would think about our thing to look at. So I didn't choose that. And indeed, that's what she chose. She chose mm-hmm. a flower. And I didn't pick that out of my mind because I thought that I was thinking that for some other reason.
I had the same experience. Even as he was going out the door, I was thinking, if I were doing it, I'd go look up the road or down the road one way or the other. I'd look out, see the road disappearing into the trees in the distance. And I kept thinking about that, but that's not what I do. I thought until, you know, I just sat here until I do something else. Because I thought that was my idea.
Uh-huh.
If he knew, he went out and stood and looked up the road.
That's true.
Okay, maybe even a little precognition there. You knew it before it happened. Or maybe he was thinking that as he walked out the door. But that's also a good awareness. We don't trust this kind of knowing. We've got a figuring mind that really knows what's real, right? So we often override any impressions that we get because we've learned not to trust them.
Well, when you were giving examples at the very beginning, I mean, the thoughts were crossing my mind. I was fighting against those becoming the basis of thought, and being still aware, you know, open to something else. But those examples just caused kind of a predisposition toward a direction.
Okay, well, you probably didn't expect this kind of introduction to prayer, right? But I think it's part of it. Let's turn now. I know that the others of you would like to experience it, but I'd like to move on, given the shortness of the session time.
Why do you think that the mystical side of spirituality has been denied by organized religion for so long?
Well, a number of thoughts around that. I think it's hard to control. It's hard to systematize. And we went through a stage of wanting to nail down systems of theology and systems of thought, and we wanted to get an organized view of life, you know, so we've had that great need, and I think ruled out the mystical level in a lot of ways. What was the first gift of healing that God gave us? I'll answer my own question rather than play guess games. For me, it was, and on the seventh day, God rested. that the Sabbath is a gift of healing. It's a time to let go of that striving and straining and working and moving out and coming back in, knowing who we are by the grace of God, deepening our trust, deepening our peace, which is the seedbed of health and healing, and being refreshed. That, to me, is what the Sabbath is about. And I think any society that denies the Sabbath is headed for increasing rates of cancer and heart illness, etc. And we may see that happening in our society. Jesus said to the paralytic, the man lowered through the ceiling, "Is it better to say your sins are forgiven or take up your bed and walk?" What possible connection could there be between sin and illness? Well, we've gone down a route that I think has gotten us in trouble. For a time in the Middle Ages, it was really thought that illness was a punishment for something bad that you did. So it was the whole idea that we have the will to do good, and when we don't do good, that we are bad and God punishes that. And often that was used. So Jesus doesn't talk about, that this was not that you sinned in that context. He does say to the paralytic, "Go and sin no more." So he does relate sin to illness on two incidents.
But that's deeply rooted in the Old Testament. The story of Job, where his so-called friends are trying to dig out of him, "What have you done?"
Yes, yes. Well, Jesus really comes at sin in another way. Certainly he talks about the commandments, but he moves right beyond the commandments to this, like with the rich young man, he says, who has kept all the commandments, go sell all that you have and give it to the poor. Why? To make him aware of how attached he is to his riches. And so part of what we've been looking at this week is the way that out of our deep fear of being nobody, we create a somebody to create our own significance. In other language, to prove our worth. Another language, justify who we, a self that justifies us. Called the old self that must die in Romans. And this is a kind of, what happens is we start building this very early in childhood. We get a feeling, a deep feeling, that somehow we're not enough. And then we start tuning in to find out what do we need to do to be enough. And often it's whatever our parents recognize us, give us recognition for. Being good, being perfect, being this, pleasing others, being responsible,
good grades,
trying harder, etc. We begin to get some idea that if we just do enough of something or have enough of something or please others well enough, somehow we will be enough. And we build a whole life around trying to make that happen. I like the language of T.A. when it called it a script, that we write a script for our lives and we become enslaved to that script, enslaved to sin. It is sin because out of our attempt to prove our worth, we are not accepting the grace of God. God gives us our worth. You are who you are by the grace of God. You have all the worth and value and identity that you need. So when we deny that and be afraid that that's not true and then start trying to prove our worth, then it involves all kind of striving and straining and manipulation of others and so forth. And what happens is when our created somebody isn't working too well, I am somebody because I could hit the ball further. Then I have to hit the ball even further. Or I lift 10 pounds or 100 pounds, then I have to lift 200 pounds. And we always have to do more and more. Or I'm somebody because you like me, and then all of a sudden one day you ignore me. Then I've got to manipulate you all the more to get you to like me more. So the nature of that is that we become enslaved to it, and we begin to overload or overstrain our life, our systems, our bodies, to make it happen, to make ourselves 2 inches taller, to make ourselves more than we are. And in that straining, striving process, we create the seedbed for illness. Because when we tense parts of our body, we shut off blood to various organs. When we shut off blood, we often shut down the immune system. We know that depression and other things can shut down the immune system. Losses often shut down the immune system. That when we lose something, often we find that people moving into retirement get ill right after retirement, lose their job, lose a spouse, all kinds of losses, even the fear of death, can cause us to shut down our physical system as a dynamic system, and then we shut down, and then the wrong cells develop, or the germs have a seed bed. It's not the germs that cause it, but how we nurture the germs that creates the illness. So that this whole attempt to create a somebody and strive is destructive ultimately. And that's why Jesus says, he who finds his life will lose it. If somehow you've got a good thing going, it's liable to be your end ultimately. When you think you really have proved you're somebody. Even to the point, you know, like a Marilyn Monroe who has her name on the marquees all over the world, and she commits suicide. Because whatever it is, it's never enough. And just think, when you've reached the pinnacle and there's no further place to go, how do you get enough? And maybe the despair of that finally leads to giving it all up. Well, I think that Jesus certainly talks about the complexity and of sin and the complexity of illness. And yet he says the word that somehow reaches in and touches people and frees them, not only from the illness, but with his compassion, the way he approaches, he affirms, he cares, and especially for those who are the least cared for, and says the word, and they are freed from whatever way this striving is creating their problems. And sometimes it's called demon possession. And we are often so enslaved to this need to be somebody that it is like being possessed. And we have that struggle that Paul talks about, the things I would, I do not, and the things I would not, that I do. There's something controlling me that I don't fully understand. So that's part of what we're dealing with as we pray for healing, as we seek our own healing. Now, the healing process then is in Christ. We finally hear the message in many different ways that you are who you are by the grace of God. I love you. I care for you. I forgive you. I set you free from anything you have done in the past. And that then becomes the source of being at peace. At peace with ourselves, finally. And so the peace of Christ is that gift to feel, I don't need to make it happen anymore. I don't need to make me happen. I don't need to make you happen. I don't need to make anything in life happen. I can be at peace with who I am. Period. And that peace then becomes the seedbed of health. When we let go of all that striving, our our organs can begin to function again. The purpose of the Sabbath is to, again, move into that state of peace. And the purpose of Christ is to give us that peace. Also to give us hope that all things are possible so that we begin to see how we have meaning in life and see the potential of life. And then love is the way of living with fullness of meaning. There is no hopeless situation because, one, God is present, and two, you can love in any situation, so it is never hopeless. Okay. And a number of things I wanted to get included, and I want to make sure. What's possible? Let me read you a story. This is Larry Dossey writing about healing, and he says, "One of the features I adore about miracles is that they happen to sinners as well as saints. One doesn't have to wear a halo to have a miracle cure." Then he tells this story. Rita Klaus developed her first symptoms of multiple sclerosis. Let's see, would someone be willing to read this? I find my voice is getting a catch. I've got a cold.
I don't want to read. If you, I've already wanted to read.
Start right there with Rita Klaus. Okay, down to here, I guess. It's quite a bit.
So but, where was it right there again?
Yeah, but it's quite a story.
Rita Klaus developed her first symptoms of multiple sclerosis at age 20 while a nun. Unable to meet the demands of convent life, she was given dispensation from her vows. She finished her college degree in biology and became a science teacher in a junior high school outside Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She married and had three children. She progressed rapidly, and she was soon confined to a wheelchair with complete paralysis of both feet and ankles. Contractures and spasticity caused structural deformities of her legs, along with intractable sciatic pain. Certain she would never walk again, her doctor surgically severed the tendons in her legs that kept her kneecaps in place. This permitted her to hobble short distances inside her house with full-length leg braces and forearm crutches. Although formerly an extremely religious nun, Klaus's spiritual beliefs evaporated like a snowball on a hot stove. "It's a bunch of malarkey," she said. "God does not intervene in the natural order. Every time I see these televangelist creeps, I feel like puking." Despite her rejection of her former beliefs, she allowed her husband to take her to a church service where healing was performed, during which she was prayed over, touched, and hugged. She felt the strangest experience. As she described it, there was just this white light, a feeling of absolute love like I'd never felt coursing through me. I felt forgiven and at peace. I wasn't physically healed, but had peace of heart, of knowing I was loved and could weather anything. The years passed and her disease got worse. Her doctors told her there was no hope of improvement and that her nerves and tissue were damaged irreversibly. But in the ensuing years, her faith returned and she resumed her prayers. Then one night, she heard a voice extending an invitation to her to be healed. She awoke the next day, went to a class in her wheelchair, and began to feel sensations of heat and itching in her lower legs. To her astonishment, she realized she could wiggle her toes. Thinking this must be muscle spasms, she dismissed it. Then, when she got home, she bent down to remove her leg braces and noticed that her right kneecap, which had been in a deformed sideways position since the tendons were cut, had somehow migrated back to its normal position. She said later, "I just remember screaming, 'My God, my leg is straight.'" Then she shed her remaining braces, removed her socks, tucked up her skirt, and said to herself, "If I am cured, I can run up the stairs," which she did, all 13 steps. Her next venture was outdoors. She ran from the house through the woods, jumped a creek, and came back covered with leaves and mud.
She called her priest shouting, "I'm healed, I'm healed." The poor man thought she had gone mad. "I want you to sit down, calm down, take some aspirin and call your doctor," he stammered. Still babbling, she called a girlfriend who came over and shared a good cry. The following Monday, her husband took her to the rehabilitation hospital. Writers Carlisle Hishberg and Mark Ian Barash, in their book, Remarkable Recovery, describe what happened. The doctors who convened to examine her were flabbergasted. As the nurses scurried for her charts and patients gawked and craned, the doctors' reactions tellingly varied. One of my doctors saw me and started to laugh. He thought I must have had a twin who I'd brought in to play a practical joke on him. Her neurologist, she says, was so angry. He said there is no cure for MS, no such thing as miracles. He even called people at the hospital and told them I was a fraud and a fake. There seemed to be little doubt about Claus's cure. Dr. Donald Meissner examined her and found no trace of MS. When word of the case leaked out, he said to local newspaper, "Spontaneous remissions of multiple sclerosis are possible. The only thing that doesn't fit here is that usually the permanent damage that had occurred up to the point of remission does not go away. In Rita's case, every evidence I could see would suggest that she is totally back to normal."
Thank you. We can welcome those kinds of stories because we can either say there must have been something phony there, often as people who want to be very scientific say, or we can say, wow, that sure opens my window of potentiality. That prayer can change the physical, repair the damage. Mm-hmm. That's more than just some relief. So that becomes the range of possibility. Some of the things Jesus did. One is Jesus listened, and listened compassionately. And so the beginning of healing is listening. What does a person really want and need? It is not a good thing for us always to decide what a person should have and should need. So the more, and if it's a long distance, we need to tune in a long distance way, be with another person and sense where they're at and what they need. Use our intuition. If we're visiting a sick person, to ask them, "What would you like me to pray for? What do you sense you need?" And I shared with some of you a day or two ago. Anyway, I went and prayed for a woman who was in her early 40s and had cancer, and I assumed that she wanted to get well. And the more I prayed for her healing, and I thought, man, I'm doing a pretty eloquent job of this, the more agitated she became. And then it finally struck me, whoa, stop. Maybe for some reason she has a need to die. And there were quite a few people there, and I wasn't able to talk to her about that. I wasn't her pastor, I was a person who knew her, so I wasn't there on regular visits. But she died not long, much later, and I regretted that I hadn't had the time to really talk with her and tune into her well before I was invited by friends to come in and pray for her healing, and I bought into that.
Did she know you were praying for her?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, she was conscious. Mm-hmm. Now, notice that with the lame man by the pool of Bethsaida, 38 years, been waiting to get into the pool, and someone always jumps in ahead of him. And time after time, "Have mercy on me, O Lord." And what is Jesus' response? A question. Do you want to be healed? Now, What a question. It looks so apparent. This guy's been waiting by this healing pool, trying to get in for years and years, and everyone beats him. Why would Jesus ask such a question?
I think there's some people who enjoy being ill.
You got it.
Position they're in.
What was his significance in life? What was his somebody?
Illness.
I'm the poor man who never gets into the pool. That had become his identity. That justified his existence. And he was so entrapped to that, that Jesus cuts through all of that and says, hey, wait a minute, do you really want to be healed? Are you ready to let go of it? Mm-hmm. So an important question for us ourselves is, how may I want my illness? What is it doing for me? Another aspect of praying for things, do not pray, for instance, for your children that they not get sick, because that's a very deadly prayer. What happens if children don't have any illnesses?
Don't get an immune system.
They don't build an immune system. So it may sound caring, but again, it's not tuned in well to. So to let illness be a part of life, because often it is that which strengthens us and in some ways is a gift for us. So that we don't approach it as though it's something that has to be eliminated. Some of the approaches of Jesus, sometimes would touch, sometimes would hold his hand out and bless him. That's a good thing to do. It's a way of being in touch, and also I find it a way to move to being with or present to that other person. It's a way of communicating and being in touch. It's not just a symbol. To demonstrate that, therapeutic touch is a treatment mode that is being taught now, developed by Dolores Krieger of New York. And many nurses are using it. What it is merely working with the energy field, not touching a person, but merely stroking the energy field an inch or two away from the person. Well, they wanted to test whether this has any effectiveness. So they had people who had, had a lesion on their hand. I think they gave everyone a lesion on their hand in the experiment, and then they would put their hands through a screen and to receive healing. And at times that they didn't know, there was a therapeutic touch person who did, without touching, did a healing process. And then at times there was no one there. And those who did it when the therapeutic touch person was there, the rate of healing was much fuller and faster than for the other group. And so whether it was the intention or whether it was the therapeutic touch, but something caused a higher rate of healing.
A few years ago, we had someone up here in Olden that taught us how to do that. And what she taught us after we learned the technique is that after you've done it with a person, you can do it without them even there, and they will get the benefit of the, I mean, thousands of miles away, that they would get the benefit of the same healing touch. Mm-hmm.
Another is that Jesus created images for the blind man to form a ball of mud. So that what has been discovered is that if you imagine something, again, if you hold an image in your mind of what you want to have happen with a person, it will affect that happening. And there was a study done of 13 people imagining either activating or calming characteristics for the person they were thinking of. And again, it had a significant effect on the person. That if we really wish a person to be calm and centered and so forth, or if we wish a person to be agitated, that we can affect another person with those images. Which makes it serious about what we're doing and what is possible. Number of things. My time is up. Would you be willing to spend 10 minutes till it would be 2 minutes to 5 when I finish?
Totally.
Willing to do that?
Sure.
I'd love to. I've got to get my kids so my husband can go to the next one. So I'll speak out now so I don't.
Sure. Understandable.
Have you had experience with using group prayer or group thought to manifest those things that you want to create?
Yes, and I would say what I think we need, one is we need group prayer to support one another. I appreciate that churches do have prayer chains, but I think we need to pray with one another and support prayer and open up our images and sense the power of group prayer. And what I was going to do, if I had a little more time, was form groups of three and guide you through some things. Mm-hmm. But the time got away. And that would be part of my sense of what we need to do to grow in our sense of the power and effectiveness of prayer. Because I think our churches, I don't know if you agree, but that we pray and we have some expectation that God will do something, but often don't expect much specific to happen. Does that fit mm-hmm. for you, what's happening in the church? Okay. So if we're going to change this, we need to get together and first and foremost, I think, for our own spiritual growth. I'm a little concerned if we only do it for others, because there's there's something wrong if I think others need to be healed but not me. And I think it starts with me, and I think we need more opportunity in our churches to really deal with our own spiritual life and opening up our own faith and our own healing. Sometimes this stoic Scandinavian approach of, I don't need anything, I don't need anybody, it gets in the way of that. Also, if we really pray for ourselves first in a group and learn how to ask, what we learn is how to receive. A major issue for me is that we haven't been open really to receiving God's healing, God's love, God's affirmation. It's all about first receiving in order that we can then give. And when we dare to show our weakness to one another and say, boy, I really need this, would you pray for me? It's a way of opening up to receive. I went to a Christian businessman's group one day. This was quite a number of years ago. And the group, after lunch, read a Bible verse or passage and talked about it. And they talked about it in very real ways. Man, this has to do with my life in this way, or this is my issue in my life. I was, wow, they were really being real about what it means to struggle with many of these issues in our life. And then they had some kind of a group prayer as closing. And then he said, okay, now all of you who have any kinds of needs, ask others to pray with you. Join a huddle. And all the men stood up, and in groups of three or four, and it got in one. My wife's going into surgery, and I'm really kind of scared, and I don't know what to do. Oh, okay, we'll pray with you. And they were very real requests for prayer. Wow, this is exciting. And so anyway, I would covet that for our Lutheran fellowship so that we can get a very personal sense of what this can be. Many years ago, I went to a Baptist church called Broadway Baptist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. And I actually flew quite a ways out of my way to go visit it. I was interested in group life in the church. And I went, and they said, well, just about every member of our church is in a group, a Bible study, spiritual growth group. And the way they said it was, we do our homework, in a sense, in these groups. We learn, we pray, we heal. And then they said, we come together on Sunday morning to celebrate what has been happening all week. Huh? Oh, really? And I reflected on my own Lutheran experience. It's like we come together to make it happen, all within 1 hour. And that it's not like lifting up and celebrating what's been going on. This is it, folks. And we keep wanting to put more and more in that hour so we can get everything in.